morning. Welcome to the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Manhattan. I'm Dick Beeman. It's another beautiful, sunny Indian summer day out there. And I want to welcome everybody, especially welcome visitors. If you are visiting or have not been here too many times, I encourage you to sign the guest book in the back entrance and indicate there whether you would like to receive our newsletter. The UUFM is a welcoming congregation. We are a diverse group that includes believers and non-believers, skeptics and mystics, spiritualists and earth worshipers, seekers and searchers. We also have a great diversity of programming, and if any particular program is not exactly your cup of tea, just come the following week, and you may find that that program is just what the doctor ordered. We have no creed but adhere to the seven principles listed on the back of your order of service. One of these principles is that we have respect for the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part, and this includes respect for the earth, which relates to today's topic on solar alternatives to reckless exploitation of the earth's resources. The announcements are in the insert, on the back of the insert, in your order of service, and also on the last page. No one handed me any other announcements, so I guess that's it for announcements, and I will light the chalice. Here are some words from the poet Jeb Dickerson as we light the chalice. Morning is when the wick is lit, a flame ignited, the day delighted with heat and light. We start the fight for something more than we had before. And for the song today, we're going to sing the words that are written in the yellow insert. And this is a familiar tune. You all know it. Siyahamba. Well, you may not realize that you know it, but you actually do know it. You will chime in. It's a very short one, so let's go through it twice. The first time we're going to dance to the light of the sun. The second time we're going to sing to the light of the sun. All right? We are dancing in the light of the sun. We are dancing in the light of the sun. Join me and stand. We are dancing in the light of the sun. We are dancing in the light of the sun. We are dancing. We are dancing. We are dancing in the light of the sun. We are dancing. We are dancing. We are dancing in the light of the sun. We are singing in the light of the sun. We are singing in the light of the sun. We are singing in the light of the sun. We are singing in the light of the sun. We are singing. We are singing. We are singing in the light of the sun. We are singing. We are singing. We are singing in the light of the sun.
That was a familiar tune, wasn't it?
Next. We'll now have joys and concerns.
My joy is the Cub Scout popcorn is in. So if you order popcorn after service, you can pick it up.
What a joy. We had a very successful book sale, and I want to thank all the members of the book club who worked, and also Dave Lambert and Jane Pelletier, who were not in the book club but worked very hard, and also Jennifer Bryan, who wasn't able to work that day but had the thoughtfulness to bring us a plate of chocolate chip cookies, so that'll work.
I'm performing in the Silver Orchestra with the Gold Orchestra at McCain on Monday night at 7 p.m.
Our son Charles Extel has been back from Brazil for the last 4 weeks, and it's been great having him at home.
Others?
Concern for the families of Attack Company 128 Infantry in Fort Riley. Three soldiers in one platoon were killed over the last week in indirect fire attacks over in Afghanistan.
Thank you for those. Bear in mind joys and concerns expressed and not expressed. I have a few brief readings before the children's story. Augustin Mouchot said, quote, "One must not believe, despite the silence of modern writings, that the idea of using solar radiation for mechanical operations is a recent one. On the contrary, one must recognize that the idea of harnessing the sun is very ancient, and its slow development across the centuries has given birth to a number of intriguing devices." Mouchot made that statement back in 78. That's 1878. Sir George Porter, who died at the age of 82 in the year 2002, 10 years ago, was a Nobel Prize-winning British photochemist, president of the Royal Society of London and founder of a company called Applied Photophysics. He said, "I have no doubt that the human race will be successful in harnessing the sun's energy. If sunbeams were weapons of war, we would have had solar energy centuries ago." Sir George might have been a bit too optimistic because the ancient Greeks actually used to use the reflective properties of their bronze shields to focus sunlight and to set fire to wooden enemy warships of the Roman Empire. That's according to the U.S. Department of Energy website. And finally, this also from the U.S. Department of Energy website, they have a section where they predict the future trajectory of solar technology. And two of their predictions are, first, that all homes will, in the not-too-distant future, be energy self-sufficient. And secondly, within 10 years, photovoltaic power will be cost-competitive with electricity from fossil fuels. And now, if the children would come forward, Sylvia has a very nice story about an argument between the sun and the moon.
Well, let me explain. Okay, I make the grass and the seeds grow. The energy for me makes them grow. Well, and then the chicken comes and eats that energy, the seed and the grass, and benefits from the energy that was stored in that food. And then the chicken makes the egg. And so you see, the egg is actually made with the it's possible to make it using the energy from me. And I might point out another thing. This realm is called the solar system, not the lunar system. Oh, well, I guess we'll have to continue this discussion at a later date.
Our speaker today is Bill Dorsett. Bill is well known to many of you, has been for a long time. Bill has long been a supporter of progressive and environmental causes in the Manhattan area. He has a deep interest in social action. He's been very active in MAPJ, dating back to its previous incarnation as the Manhattan Alliance for Central America. He was a dedicated participant in the Nicaraguan aid effort in the 80s and 90s. He's been a reliable presence at anti-war protests, whatever the weather. He's a spokesperson for No NBAF Germ Lab in Kansas. He's a man of many talents. When he's not pursuing his passion for social action or promoting solar energy alternatives and being a sunrite, he can often be found working his trade as an accomplished carpenter. And those are only some of his talents and interests. Today, Bill is going to speak to us a little bit about what motivates him and also give his vision of solar energy for the future. Bill, welcome.
Good morning. When Dick asked me to do this, he asked me if I could keep this kind of in a spiritual way, and it's really hard for me to disconnect from hardware from spiritual, and I hope it doesn't become too mechanical for you. These are the basic reasons, and I think it still holds today, and these are the reasons why I'm interested in... Okay, just a minute. Bear with me. There we go. These are the reasons I got into solar energy to begin with. That's the reason I stay with it. I think that we as a society have a lot of choices, and they're narrowing fairly quickly to either conventional power or renewable energy. And I think that these are things that we need to think about. We've been thinking about them for a long time, and I thought to understand where we're going, we need to understand where we've been. And these are some slides that I took from an old journal that I have from a long time ago. Down here you have, down in the right corner down here, there's a, let's see if I can do this without blanking things out again. There's a butane cordless iron. There's a converting a sewing machine to hand power. This was fairly typical of what we were talking about not so very long ago. Now, to me, it seems like not so very long ago, but to young people, but most of them are in the nursery at this point. So you'll identify with most of these things. This was 1990. It doesn't seem that long ago that we were still doing 12-volt systems that were based on batteries. And the batteries are still the least expensive energy storage system for independent systems, and they provide a backup for grid-tied systems, and they can also provide backup to grid-tied systems. But they add a lot of cost and maintenance and liability and danger, inefficiency and complexity. And this is You'll see where I burned a contact really badly when I got him crossed by accident, and it was very scary. Most of the changes we've seen in the solar panels that we're dealing with today are very much like the ones we used to have in the 90s. But the difference that's happened since then are in the control electronics. Back in 85, we were still, I think, talking about whether there was a new ice age coming. And we had these inverters that, we had inverters that changed the electricity to kind of close to a sine wave. We're trying to mimic the red line in between. That's what the utility puts out. And that's the kind of electricity you get from a wall socket. And so we've been trying to mimic that, but our efforts have been kind of, they've been faltering. 93, we got a first, this was a modified sine wave that kind of went squared and kind of took some of the corners out of the sine. And then back in 1997, we actually got a sine wave inverter. This was about the time that the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change first issued its reports. The systems at that time were about $4 a watt. By 2001, we had sine wave inverters, but these you could connect directly to the power lines. And that was something that was brand new. We no longer had to depend on batteries and things that were really iffy. And so you could dispense with batteries at that point. There were still some concerns about it. But global warming had pretty much been confirmed. And down at the bottom, by 2012,
I think everybody's concerned about global warming. And
the price of modules right now of solar panels, instead of $20 in 1985, have dropped to about 75 cents per watt. So there's a major difference in the way that we're dealing with solar electricity today. Now, some of you, I should be clear, we've had solar thermal for a long time, and it still works. It works as well today as it did back in the 90s. We'd use pretty much the same type of system today that we would use in the 90s. It's more accessible, but what I'm here to talk about primarily is solar electric systems. And those are just two distinct different things. One gives electricity and the other gives heat. This is kind of what solar photovoltaics is coming to at this point. We have solar panels that feed into an inverter right there, and it goes back into the main panel of your house and then back onto the power lines. Now, one of the disadvantages is that it doesn't have, if your lines do get iced over, you still don't have any storage because there are no batteries left. But the ease of putting them up is tremendously easy. This was the hardware that we put up over at UFM, and this is the inverter that we put in. You can see that these panels, there's five strings, or three strings of five panels in it. And they're wired positive, negative, like batteries in your flashlight. And what happens is that when they get up here into the very top up here, it's very high voltage DC. And direct current is very much more dangerous than other types of current. And so it's probably still in the realm of professionals. Only professionals would know how to work with this type of people who've done it for a long time would know how to deal with 300 and 400, up to 600 volts DC. It comes down to this inverter where it's converted into 240 volt electricity, just like you have at your house, like you plug your stove into or other things. There are many troubles with this type of inverter, but primarily it's the high voltage that makes me concerned. These are some of the problems that we had with this type of module or this type of inverter. And one of the problems that we're finding more and more is that you can't replace panels if one is damaged. It's a rare event, but over periods of time, corrosion does happen. This is something that happened about 4 years ago, and this frees up the whole industry like we've never had before.
When it was batteries, I never understood how you would be able to come up with enough lead to be able to build batteries for everybody. That was the supply of lead just was not large enough to be able to do that. The other problem was that we couldn't find enough people in the country who knew how to operate them. You'd have to train electricians, and it adds a whole lot of problems in terms of trying to work with batteries. So these are the first ones that every panel, every module on your solar array would have one of these little inverters. And it's a tiny little inverter, and because every panel has its own inverter, you're not as afraid of shading as you were with old string inverters. The old string inverters, if one part of it got shaded, then the rest of it was like a garden hose that you stepped on. It would stop the electricity coming out of the rest of the, you know, for the rest of the system. These you don't have to worry about. The thing is that they also have monitoring, so it's real easy to see exactly what's going on with each solar panel and inverter. So, and you can expand them one step at a time or one module at a time instead of big blocks of expensive modules. And if the problem doesn't matter anymore in terms of matching the modules, because the replacements only have to have the same footprint as your other one. They don't have to have the same electrical output. And so the other thing that really appeals to me, and the thing that is making these so popular right now, is it's within the range of everybody's skills. It's not like dealing with batteries or the old inverter type assist or the old battery bank systems where you had independent systems. These, you just plug in this, you bolt it onto the rack, and you plug this into a line, and that's all there is. Anyone can do it. I mean, this makes solar electricity within the realm of any electrical shop in the country, any roofing company in the country, any homeowner. So these are panels that you can, all you need is a rack on the roof or on the ground, and you bolt the little inverters on the top, on the side of it. You plug them in just to the ends of the inverter. And so it's really plug and play. You take this down to your main breaker box and put it on a standard breaker like you have at your home. Everybody's familiar with these. So it's become something that anyone can do. You can look at them on your smartphone. You can see exactly in real time exactly what each panel is putting out. This one is 118 watts, you know, so on. The next change of this, and the direction that I see the industry going right now, is that we're going with straight AC modules. And these are modules where you don't have to have, you're not dealing with DC at all, so there's none of the danger involved with working with high voltage wiring. This is one of the inverters right here, and it's just plugged right into the output from the panel. Some of them have replaced this little box, the junction box on the panel, with an inverter itself. So really, there's only a wire coming out of it, and there's never any DC coming out of the panel. It's all strictly AC. There's a channel on the side of the panel for bolting it onto the roof. It reduces the labor, and they just slide together and plug in. And so this is one by Westinghouse, but there are dozens of new panels that are coming up with this, you know, similar designs. So what's in the way? At this point, the price has already crossed into what people would pay for utility power. At 60 cents a watt and 70 cents a watt, these have already crossed over to the point where they're already competing with utility power. We don't have to wait. This is not something in the future. In fact, when I was the reason that I brought that the little model out behind the fellowship out here is that I wanted to understand that this isn't, you know, we're not talking about unicorns here. These are real. They're an existing hardware that's on the market that you could buy, you know, anytime. in spite of the fact that we were bombarded with all of the hype and the advertising about renewable energy being flaky, almost there's a very high majority of Americans from both parties who are in favor of renewable energy and solar in particular. So this is something that I think has got popular support. It, in terms of reducing our carbon footprint, this is coal. This is where we get it right now. And I think that many of these things are real. And I think that if you have this box here on peak coal, they believe that we're going to be to the limit of our recoverable coal in about 20 years, 20 to 30 years. So we can expect the utility prices to be ramping up. As it becomes less and less economical to recover the coal, of course the prices will increase. So the cost of utilities will increase dramatically. At that point, solar certainly matches up and certainly competes. One of the other things they talk about, you know, the proponents of fossil fuels are saying that, well, it's not constant, and you really can't supply the power for all the time. The point is that we really don't have to. If you combine renewable energy resources, you have the peaks from wind. In Kansas, probably only 23% of the wind is peak load power. The rest of it is off-peak power. Peak power is when, let me explain that. In the day when you have people going to work and turning on their furnaces and cooking and going to their offices and working, that's when all utilities have a big spike in terms of what they require in terms of electricity. So if you match, you know, solar exactly matches what the peak load is, because a large part of our peak load comes from heat, air conditioning, things like that. And so these are the things we live during the day. We go to the office, we fire up our computers, we do all those things during the day. We cook, we turn on the lights. All of those things happen during the day. And if you match solar energy with wind energy, it provides something that's a fairly close, you know, you can see the same pattern going on through there. Now, again, I don't believe that solar energy is certainly is not the only answer, but it is one of the answers. And I think that, you know, as you see up here, that's where the mass of it is. That's what Doug has been working on for 30 years. Is inefficiency. And efficiency is where most of it's going to happen and where the really inexpensive changes are going to happen. And that's where, you know, before anybody did anything solar on their house, make sure that you weatherize it. Make sure that you insulate the attics. Make sure that you do all of those things that are important before you consider solar. But one of the mixes, again, is solar, which is this photovoltaics right here. These charts are from Amory Lovin's book, Reinventing Fire. And it's a remarkable book on energy futures. And this is what Amory and his staff at the Rocky Mountain Institute have come up with as a reasonable alternative. And this is actually the second most progressive. The most progressive is one where actually, he has photovoltaics and solar electricity being a fairly larger amount of the total picture. And again, efficiency is where most of it is. These are what we do today. This is no change. This is coal and nuclear. And if you listen to them, they'd add biomass to it. You know, it's another combustion product. But this is what I think is a more reasonable solution, and I think it's probably what we're going to be seeing more and more of. One of the things that we're trying to do right now, I'm calling myself retired. I'm interested in working strictly on solar work. And so that's really what I'm focusing on right now. I'm focusing on organizing a renewable energy cooperative where we can buy the hardware in bulk and help each other put them on each other's houses. The difference is that this is, and I give total credit for this model to the Plymouth Area Renewable Energy Initiative. And this is Plymouth, New Hampshire. And they have started, they've been at it for about 7 or 8 years now. And their focus at this point is on solar heating, solar hot water primarily. And also they also insulate houses and work on efficiency and teach people on how to do this. And I really would encourage anybody who's interested in this to look up Perry, P-A-R-E-I, on, you can Google it and come up with their website. But if we help each other, it's basically the old barn raising model where we can buy the hardware and then help each other put them on each other's houses. And doing that, we can eliminate. Let's see. Well, okay. The labor and the installer's overhead is about 55% of the cost of a system. And so if we can help each other put these up, then I think we can have costs that are down to, you know, and I just talked to a couple of people who have had bids on systems that were $28,000 and $30,000 that were absurd. I mean, it was a huge amount for what people should be paying for this stuff. And I think that this is probably the one down here that most people are going to be going for. And if you take the 30% tax credit off of it, it's $5,000, which is fairly reasonable for most people. At that point, it's 25 years worth of electricity for going on. And with no increase in price, the same as you have the others. This is kind of the summation of what I. This is from Funny Times, and I think this is it. I mean, if it is a hoax, this is what we should be doing anyway. I said that I would keep this presentation fairly short. If you have questions, I'd be happy to answer what I can. I'm sure that between Doug and me and whoever else here, I'm sure we can answer whatever you'd like. We can try anyway. Are there any questions? Ann?
Ann Cowan. What are the politics of all of this? And also, secondly, how do the present energy corporations either fight this or support it?
At this point, we're fairly new in terms of presenting, in terms of buying bulk quantities of modules and selling them at fairly close to cost. We'll have some operating expenses. And I think that we're going to have the same kind of problems that many cooperatives have had through history. We're going to have people saying, well, that's not, you know, this isn't how it should work. We, you know, co-ops have had problems with this forever. But there are groups starting in Wichita and Omaha. It's not only here in Manhattan, and I think there's enough of us who are recognizing that there's an urgency to this that has never been there. And someone has to be able to provide a different alternative fairly soon. There is a point at some point, it may be the 350 parts per million carbon or carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. It may, who knows? I'm not sure where that is. But I think that I think it's important that we get started as soon as possible. And I think that this is not, I mean, this depends on somewhat the economics, somewhat depend on the tax credits. But I think that it's popular enough, and I think it's recognized well enough across around the country and around the world right now that it's not something we can just discard. I mean, the poll numbers on renewable energy still made it so that it's popular enough that it would be hard to just trash it at this point. And I think the economics are in our favor at this right now for a number of reasons. John?
Well, you've talked about residential solar. What about transportation? And let me just relate what I saw on a PBS program a few years ago. I think it was a new system they're putting in Denmark where they use wind to store electricity in batteries, which are designed to plug into automobiles. And the idea is that you would use these instead of filling up the gas tank. You would have automatic replacements when you go to a so-called gas station, which you just drive your car over, and it would take out the old battery, plug in the new one. Anyhow, what do you think about that? Because most of our energy consumption is not in in residential use. It's in transportation. That's where we use our oil and our gasoline.
I agree, John, and Sam was just telling me about an article that he'd read about, or a program that you saw on electric vehicles. And one of the scenarios that Amory Levins has in his book is using the batteries on electric vehicles as a charging source, where you charge those up in storage, and then when you take them home, you plug them in, and it provides an ability to either drive or to have storage for evening hours. I think there's a number of ways of stretching out that corner, and I think Mark Mosier has got that. Mark's tracker is also in that same, I think Mark is in direct competition with batteries and other storage technology, because tracking allows you to be able to produce electricity later in the day and earlier in the morning. And so I think the idea of tracking on a utility level is a very good idea. It fills out those corners of the peak when the sun goes down at 5 o'clock and comes up at, basically it's really, most of its output is finished at about 3 o'clock. I mean, it gradually slows down. But tracking is something that would have a big effect on that. But I think electric vehicles are certainly going to happen, and I think that it's going to be probably a lot cheaper to drive electric vehicles. And most of our trips, probably 98% of our trips are local. Probably most of our driving is local. So we're within the range of plugging in most places. Now, some people are on the road, and okay, we'll have to either develop different batteries for those systems, or we're going to have to be able to use some other type of combustion product. And it could be hydrogen. We could store hydrogen and use that as a fuel. Solar can also electrolyze water, so we're getting hydrogen and oxygen as an output from that. So we're not. I don't think we have to completely eliminate combustion products, but I think the source of the combustion products can be from different places that are much more benign than oil. I think it's absurd to be burning. It's absurd to be burning oil. These phenomenal molecules that our grandchildren will be saying, "I wish we had those back." It was absolutely stupid. It was like the last Buffalo Run or something like that. Yes.
The 5,000 on the numbers you had up there, is that the co-op price?
Yep.
And that's after the tax credit?
No, that's after the tax credits. And the thing about them is that it makes it really, I mean, at that point, it's probably close to half the price of what you find them on the market, because half of it is overhead. Now, we're not going to have no overhead. We're going to have probably a tool lending library for safety harnesses and things like that, so people are safe on the roof. Probably have to have some liability insurance. And there will be a little bit of advertising, but nothing like what we have. We have probably 8 or 10 families who want to put these on their roofs right now. And I'd like to start doing this once a month for, you know, and as much as anything, it's bringing people's attention to it. It's saying, hey, this is in front of you. It's not something you have to wait for. You know, this is, you know, now the technology will change, and I don't know where it'll go from here. This is about as far, an AC module that's getting AC directly off the roof is about as far as solar, conventional solar panels can go. And I think that the reason that they'll have about the same size and the same shape because it's about what one person can handle. I mean, these panels are about, a little over 5 feet high and about a meter wide, 3 feet wide, a little over. And they're kind of, you have to pay attention when you're putting them on a roof. So that's probably the configuration that we're going to see a lot of. The electronics will become more stable under hot temperatures and things like that. But that's the model that probably will happen. Whether it's glass on the sides of buildings or roofing panels or something of the sort, it may be, you know, spray coated onto roofing panels. And there are new types of systems that are made with plastic. Canarco was one where they had a semiconducting plastic, a polymer. And so these could be run out like trash bag plastic. I mean, there's theoretically no limit to what could be done with that. The question is, how do you harvest the electrons on the other side and make them useful? But probably it'll be very similar to what you're looking at here. I mean, this change has happened in 20 years. That, historically, that is dramatic. And I could easily see, and I don't think people really realize what the magnitude of this change is. I don't think the utilities have understood how dramatically their world is going to change. There's some bugs to work out in terms of how you integrate with the utilities, but we're replacing some of their most expensive generating capacity, and we're paying for it. So they'll feed back, and they'll pay us for the power coming in, or going from our system going out. But you know, at this point, those are administrative details. The hardware is here. I mean, it's not like we're waiting. Yes.
Yeah, okay. The question that came to mind to me was for the current availability of full efficiency solar cells, the discussion is about how much energy it takes to produce the solar cell compared to the amount of energy that the solar cell provides during its life. And that,
okay.
that I think you know the argument. And the question gets more important as you say in your description here that part of making it cost effective is to see the cost of energy go up, which means if that's the cost of creating the solar cell is going up along with it. So it's kind of an important question. Maybe you answered it by talking about plastic instead of baked solar cells, but what's your thoughts on that, the cost of or the energy to produce versus the life energy produced?
I think it depends very much on the type of solar panel that you're talking about, or solar cell you're talking about. Again, if it's plastic, if it's a polymer, then there's not a lot to it. It also depends very much on right now we're in this period where single silicon crystals are the panels that we're seeing most of. They're more efficient than any of the others. But those are the ones that are being produced in mass quantities right now. And so, you know, those are made by slicing an ingot of pure silicon and slicing and then treating it so that it's a silicon solar cell. Those use a lot of silicon compared with, say, the amorphous silicon ones that are vapor deposited onto a substrate, onto sheet metal or glass or any number of things. It could be roofing material. It could be window glazing. It could be all kinds of things as a substrate underneath it. And those use very much less silicon than the standard modules that we're looking at this point. The standard multicrystalline silicon module, the payback is about 2 years, and the modules will last about 25 years. So the energy payback is fairly quick. Now, that's a different question than how much it would take to pay the energy input to the whole frames and racks and arrays and inverters and wire and everything else that's involved. So it is more complicated than that. But I think that, you know, we've already crossed that point where we're cheaper than peak load power, for certain. We passed that probably 4 years ago. And I don't honestly know that I can't honestly tell you that the prices right now will continue after the glut of solar panels have been absorbed. Right now, I mean, that's why I'm interested in it right now, and why I'm interested in starting the co-op right now is because they're very affordable right now. I would probably still think that the best investment in many ways is going to be cellulose in your attic. I mean, that's clear. I mean, there's no comparison. But we're at the point in energy production where solar should be one of the parts of the mix. Yes.
I'm back.
Sorry.
Anne asked about the resistance from political systems and governmental systems, but I was curious if you've given this presentation to businesses and how they respond, and also new construction. Are they looking at this?
Not in Kansas. Kansas, of course, is very conservative in what we do. But in Washington, Oregon, New Mexico, Arizona, in places that have much worse weather than we have, much worse weather. New Jersey, has far more solar than we have. It's probably the third in the country. And they have far fewer resources than we have, solar or wind. Same with Germany, actually. You know, I mean, there was a period of time this year when for one day they were approaching 50% of their energy needs were being produced by solar electricity. So, you know, a lot of the concerns about saturating the power lines with solar instead of, you know, coal or nuclear are really administrative. It's not a hardware problem. California effectively said that we will include as much as 30% of their power requirements by solar. Those are administrative things. And yes, it will be a problem, but I have to wonder how long people are going to sit with, I have to wonder how long people are going to put up with above 100 degree weather and severe droughts and hurricanes that we've been putting up because of our current mix. So I think the politics are kind of hitting people over the head. I mean, they kind of have to start acknowledging at some point that, oh yes, climate change is real. I mean, that's, you know, they can only bury their heads in the sand for so long. Chris? Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. Yeah. Hi, Tom.
Going a little bit beyond photovoltaic, one of the major sources of inefficiency and power consumption is air conditioning. And Stan Cox has written a very disturbing book about how we got to where we are, largely because of air conditioning and the effects on migration of people and businesses to the Sun Belt. And in principle, you could do more efficiently air conditioning and dehumidification by direct solar conversion rather than going through photovoltaics and electricity. Where does that technology stand? Is anyone working on that, or are there technologies in the pipeline for more direct conversion of solar energy to air conditioning, refrigeration?
Tom, there is a there are these little mini split heat pumps that I've started putting in different places, and they are incredibly high efficiency. They have a SEER of about 27, which is almost double what they were 4 years ago, and they're fairly inexpensive. They're little mini splits. Fujitsu makes them, Sharp makes them, or Mitsubishi makes them. They're remarkable. And now they've come out, there is a company in China who makes all these things, of course. There's a company in China that is, I can't remember the name of it right now, that is making small mini splits that are direct current directly from PV, and so they sell them as a system with PV going to the mini split heat pump, and so they don't go through the DC convert going from AC down to DC. They go directly from DC and work from there. There are also absorption air conditioning, and in one of the solar decathlon houses, I think from the University of California, I can't remember where, they had an evaporative cooling system called the Yazaki system, and it's basically using different gases and refrigerants to be able to using heat. Now, they use heat input that's higher than you can get from most solar thermal. Now, it may be that with evaporative evacuated tube technology, you could get the solar heat that would be enough to be able to drive that kind of air conditioning. There's a lot of, you're getting into higher temperature heat, and there's some concerns about there's some problems dealing with that. If a system becomes too hot, then the cooling liquid gets damaged. I mean, glycols degrade and become more acidic and cause more corrosion and things like that. But I think that we're bound to come up with something better for air conditioning. But again, best thing you can do is insulate your attic. You know, put on white shingles instead of black ones. You know, there's some real simple things that work whether you're for heating or cooling, either one. And those are the first steps we ought to be making.
Is there any work on concentrators for small applications?
Tom, there seems to be more interest now than there has been for some time, and I'm starting to see some interest in cogenerating photovoltaics, because when the solar panels get hot, they lose efficiency. And so if you can keep them cool, then they work better, and you're also getting the byproduct heat that would come off the back of the panels. So cogenerating photovoltaics is something that I'm seeing more and more interest in. At that point, instead of, say, 16% efficiency that you'd have from electrical output, you might have more like 50% or 60%. So, you know, that's a new area.
I have a comment and then a question. The comment is, tonight on PBS there's going to be a Ken Burns film on the Great Dust Bowl years. And those who are doubting the effects of global climate change, I think, need to watch that show. I want to go back to Ann Cowan's question about the politics behind this, because, as you just said, we're a conservative state. Which I don't really believe, but I think the real issue has to be education. For people to understand what this means, they have to understand the cost-benefit analysis for them long-term. And I just don't see that happening broadly anywhere. I know what this is and what this means and what it could mean for my property value and my energy consumption. But I would think the average person out there has no idea about this. And so my question to you is, how are you going to educate the general public on the benefits of taking this route versus the traditional, I just plug it in and I don't have to think of it route?
It used to be, I mean, I remember Tom Shrimplin used to have a house off the grid in, you know, outside of Manhattan, and every once in a while, he ran his on a wind turbine, every once in a while it would, the TV would shrink down and then go brown, and, you know, then it would come back up, depending on how much power he had coming into his house. Today, it is indistinguishable. You really don't know that it's on your house at all. It doesn't affect your lifestyle. The lifestyle of keeping batteries watered and keeping them equalized and doing all of that made it so that it was almost impossible. This is so simple. I mean, Westinghouse with the AC modules is advertised as a do-it-yourself kit. There's no danger. I mean, except, you know, there's the possibility of someone tumbling off the roof if, you know, and I think that's something we have to take seriously, but it's within the skill range of almost anybody. Almost anybody can put these in. And once they see, I mean, in Oregon, they're selling them incredibly fast. In Washington, they're selling them incredibly fast. I think we will do the same here, and I think we're becoming take care of itself and to some degree, just because, like you were talking about, Christopher, you have, you know, out in western Kansas, I've already seen, you know, I pulled into a Quick Mart to get gas, and the little LED or the little LCD screen on it was fuzzed out because it was packed with mud, with dirt that had blown through, and the guy couldn't see he was saying that 2 weeks before, he said, I couldn't see the gas pumps from my desk in the store. I mean, that's real. It only has to happen a few times. And a few years ago, we watched the dust roll over Phoenix. That's the stick, and the carrot is lower cost and ease. I mean, simplicity of putting these in. I think there are some things that politically we could do to make it happen faster. One of them would be time of day pricing. The smart grid will help that out, because right now it's hard to know what, you know, we get net metering. Basically, it's just net metering. They pay us what we pay them. The meter spins backwards. But at some point, with a smart grid, they'll know when we're generating and when we're not. It's in Kansas City. There's a pilot program in Kansas City of a smart grid there, where they know where you can tell, you know, when you're using the power. Their goal is that they can define when you don't use power. You know, you dry your clothes at night instead of during the day. Should be doing it on a clothesline anyway. But the idea is that once they know when we're using power, they also will know when we're producing power. And at that point, they can pay us the full peak load generation value of this. And at that point, it's about 23 cents, 24 cents a kilowatt hour. So the cost of generating in peak load is tremendously expensive. So,
Going back to the co-op model, mm-hmm. that you have, and from a financing perspective, okay. You know, you have a group of people who are, we would call, fairly educated, who see the benefits, who would like to be involved. I think you could probably get a fairly large group of people here involved. Where does the financing come in? Have you visited lending institutions, that type of thing, to make the affordability factor, it more available to your average everyday person?
I think that's a very good question. And I haven't gone that far. I mean, in terms of going within the system, within the typical system of banking and finance, you know, we tried to do that with Efficiency Kansas. And Efficiency Kansas, the banks added another layer to it that was just unwieldy as can be. And so just that structure of having it, you know, the approval and all that process was really difficult. But I think there is the possibility of going through, I mean, if we can buy in large quantities, and I wouldn't put it out of our range right now to be able to buy it by the container and split it between groups in Wichita and Lawrence and Omaha and Kansas City and just have people bring their horse trailers down and load a pallet in the back of, you know, panel trucks and whatever else and haul them back to where they're going from. In that model, we have to have most of the money up front, but some of the module manufacturers are financing systems now. And so if you can arrange, some of the wholesalers are now arranging financing through them. It's really, I mean, the payback is reasonable. And when you talk about, and I'm not going to say it's immediate, it's certainly not as good as, you know, weatherizing your doors. But I know for me, and it's my business, has been my business for a long time. And so for me, I can call it also have it as an accelerated depreciation on the cost of the system too. So that allows me to depreciate it over 5 years, which is about another 20% of the value of the system. And so, you know, that plus the tax credits, the 30% tax credit, makes it especially affordable right now. And so one of the markets right now is also small business. I think small business is one area because it's part of the business or part of the farm that they can depreciate it quickly and write it off on their taxes fairly fast. And what they've found, and they've done surveys of realtors that will say that they actually add value to the house. So when you sell it, you can get most of your money back when you sell the house. So it's a win. It's a win-win situation from almost any perspective. And I think the people politically, I think that people will be very reticent. I mean, you have the oil interests, you know, the Koch brothers have been one, some, who've been, you know, I'm sure that that went with the package when they sponsored the Tea Party. I mean, I think that was part of the package that they would, you know, that would be part of their kind of a tacit agreement that there would be resistance to renewable energy. But I think very few people are actually buying it. I think at some point it's going to happen. Doug?
Speaking of oil, in your opinion, what does oil subsidies and huge tax breaks for oil companies do to the market of solar?
Well, I think where you're going to find it is in natural gas. I think natural gas, the low cost of natural gas, and this was a phrase. You know, we found this massive reserve in South Dakota or North Dakota in natural gas, and we're starting to find it in shale all over the place. I think as a sideline, we're going to find that it's going to have many of the same impacts that coal has. It's methane, which is a worse gas than carbon dioxide. And I think that, and so, you know, we're doing this, we're advertising this as Kansas strong for the, you know, for the nation. But Amory Lovins used to have a phrase for that. He used to call it strength through exhaustion. And I think that's a real good, real accurate description of what's going on. Yeah, politically it's unpopular to get oil and natural gas from overseas. In reality, most of it comes from Canada. But still, that whole bug of energy independence at this point, and our response to it is strength through exhaustion. Natural gas is a direct competitor with solar because it provides peaking plants, and you can fire up one of those. It's basically a jet engine. You know, you can fire up a jet engine instantly and respond to the peak load, And that's what they're doing now. So the cost of natural gas is where it probably will happen. But there's so much more to the peak load than that. It has to follow all the way through the whole system. We have to design all the wires going out, you know, going along the roads, and all the switch gear and everything else to accommodate that peak. So everything has to be oversized tremendously. In California, I think it's 40% of the typical feeder power line is running up 40% of its capacity 50% of the time. I mean, it's a very small portion, and the rest of that capacity is there just so that things don't overheat during the air conditioning and the peak load period. So it's expensive all the way through. It's not just in the fuel of natural gas. Sylvia?
Oh, I had almost forgotten that over 30 years ago when we first moved here, you and your friend Dean Dinner came to our house to see about fitting it for solar energy. So you've been interested in this a really long time. And I know you studied biology and then you traveled to India. I wondered what was the source of your social activism. You've been doing so many different things and really put yourself out against facing public criticism even sometimes. If there was like a turning point in your life?
Sylvia, I think it probably was having kids. I mean, we have to think of the next generation and the generation after them. I mean, I don't have anything to gain from this co-op. I mean, I will not gain from it financially. It'll take a lot of my time. But I have a granddaughter. I have two sons. So, yeah, that's it. Anybody else?
We have one. You want to do
okay, one more. Ann?
Well, I'll ask one more, and I think Stan Cox brought this up in his book. But we as a society are used to being very comfortable and life being easy with a flick of a switch.
Yep.
So is there a role to play here in us deciding that during the summertime we might be warm and live at 80 degrees in our house instead of 70 degrees or even 85 degrees? Is that an important role, or to not need to wear a coat when you go to the grocery store during the summer?
And I think it's unrealistic to think that we can get through this with no change in lifestyle. I mean, I think that, you know, and people have asked me what it would take to power a typical house. And to power a typical house depends on what the house is. I mean, this is a house from 2000. This was an off-grid house, and it uses 2,000 watts is its daily use. That's about the size of a 9-panel system. It's not a lavish lifestyle. I wouldn't choose, you know, the hairdryer. I wouldn't choose the, you know, the iron. And we've done a lot of things. We've done a lot of things way better, and the hardware we have is way better than it used to be. I mean, but this is not, you know, that may be unacceptable for many people. You know, having the TV on for an hour might be unacceptable for most people. I don't know. But I think to go through this, and this is just an independent house that was, you know, that was designed for running on a battery. So, you know, you have to kind of look at that and kind of compare it with what you need and what you have. You know, the computer is a fairly sizable computer. Most of our laptops don't use anywhere near that much. Solar water heating would be something that would be obvious. Solar water heating and solar water heating right now is as accessible as solar electricity is. I mean, with the new inventions of PEX tubing and shark bite fittings, you don't have to be a plumber to do solar hot water. You can install them. Anybody can install them. There's nothing difficult there. So, yeah, and I don't think that we're going to get through this without changes in our lifestyle. But I think it's doable. Anybody else?
I think we better end it here. We're a couple minutes late. Let's give Bill a hand. I'm sure Bill will hang around for a few minutes to discuss anybody who wants to discuss. So let's have coffee.